Hello there. Welcome to episode 37 of Bow and Blade, a podcast brought to you by Medievalist.net, your home for all things medieval on the internet. Bow and Blade gives you a seat at the bar as scholars of medieval warfare go beyond the Wikipedia articles to talk about the debates and the questions that we're working on today. I'm Michael Livingston, distinguished professor at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina.
And I'm Kelly DeVries, professor of history at Loyola University, Maryland, and for this year, a distinguished visiting professor at the Air Force Academy. How you doing, Mike?
I am good. I am good. What are you drinking tonight for this event?
Oh, this one was a hard one. Boy, I actually woke up in the middle of the night and the first thing I thought, what am I going to drink? you know when the podcast is taking over your life if you actually wake up in the middle of the night and that's your concern. I think, you know, I think I've got to go with a dark Balkans red wine. Mm. I know that puts me probably in the category of pro-Rome, and I'm not sure that that's what I am on this battle. But I'm thinking that over a Gothic beer.
Yeah, I mean, a Gothic beer is awfully tempting because we're going to be talking about something they win here. But yeah, I mean, I got it. Yeah. It's win in Rome. I mean, win or lose, right? So, yeah, you know, throw some spices with the wine, you know, so you get a good Roman wine, but,
that's true.
But I don't want to drink Posca or something like that. So, I think it's gotta be good Roman wine, but what we're going to talk about, they don't do well.
No. And in fact, you know, it may have been the last thing the Valens drank. We don't know. We'll talk about that.
Poor Valens.
Poor Valens. Actually, no, let's stop. Valens is an idiot.
Well, no man is a fool, except there may be exceptions.
There may be some. I mean, he just doesn't. Sometimes I wonder, you know, is it possible that he came out and, you know, I don't see how he could have lost this battle. And he does badly.
Yeah, really. Really badly. roundly defeated. We're talking, if you haven't put together the clues yet, about the Battle of Adrianople in 378.
And I know we spoiled the ending there. Sorry about that.
Historical thing.
For anybody who came in here and said, geez, don't know about this.
Yeah.
This, of course, was not the 1402 battle that Tamerlane fights. This is the battle fought in 378. We should say that.
Yeah, Adrianople has a lot of fights. it's kind of like, you know, Thermopylae that way. I mean, there's something like, 18 fights or something at Adrianople. It gets hit a lot.
Yeah.
But Adrianople 378. And I, you know, I think we should probably start actually with the fact that Bow and Blade is a medieval warfare podcast. And most folks probably do not define the Middle Ages to include 378. I was taught back in the day, roughly speaking, 500 to 1500 as a good round number for the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Of course, people have different, you know, 1492 is the cutoff date, or 1453, both good theoretical cutoff points. We've blown both those up by doing the Siege of Rhodes in 1520. Like, we just forget it, you know, we're past it.
Yeah.
But how, explain yourself, sir, that we are doing 378 in a medieval podcast.
I've got a couple of things coming out too that talk about this battle, and both of them, I am approaching it as pretty much the first battle of the Middle Ages. I'll say that. Although I did defend it among a bunch of classicists that I was with a year ago or so, as the last battle of antiquity, the last battle of the Roman, of the ancient world, and the first battle of the medieval world. And I think that's because it is the real definition of the entry of the Germanic tribes, a Germanic tribe, if not more allied in this case, into the Roman world and not leaving. And that starts, you know, in many ways, starts the snowball rolling down until within 100 years, the Western Roman Empire is gone. And the Eastern Roman Empire has become, for medievalists at least, the Byzantine Empire.
Okay, so you're thinking medieval in terms almost of kind of geopolitics here.
I do, yeah. And that, again, it was interesting you said, you know, the you had learned, you know, 500, 1500, that sort of thing. Because I came at the Middle Ages from doing ancient language, mostly literature and Latin, in university. We didn't have a lot of medieval courses in such a way, and the early Middle Ages course was defined very differently than I have even taught it. I think that's probably why I never even, you know, thought, well, 500, 1500. It came at me very much at, you know, this is the beginning of the end. Coming out of a religious institution, both Mike and I were, you know, our first university degree was from a religious university. Did you have an emphasis on Constantine? Because I think that's where, you know, everybody wanted, oh, this is the slippery slope, you know, at the end of the
We
empire.
did not. We did not have a lot of focus on Constantine. But yeah, I mean, I was also coming at it from the ancient Christian perspective, right? You know, I was publishing on first century Christianity, you know, before I went, you know, further forward. So, you know, back in the day, as an undergraduate, my first publication at a, you know, peer reviewed was first century Christianity. So yeah, I think we both kind of came at it from that direction, and it does, you know, kind of put a lens on what you're seeing, depending on which way you're coming at it. Are you coming at it from the ancient world going forward, or are you going backwards from, like, say, Chaucer or something like that, you know, and tunneling back? I think you get to different points as to where the break is. And it also depends on what you're looking for, right? And here we're talking about, you know, medieval warfare. That is a military concept, and so we're kind of interested in military separations, lines of separations. And Adrianople's a pretty good one for that.
We did the Battle of Milvian Bridge, and we didn't have this. I hate to tell you, we didn't have this discussion, and it was before. So,
Yeah, well, I might have gotten some mail
but
about
yeah,
that.
we
So
might have.
that was all Kelly, by the way. But that was,
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, to kind of a case in point, right? That's if you're going to look at a religious Middle Ages, define it by religion, that's actually a pretty good point to, I mean, the Edict of Milan, right? And sort of
Yeah.
use that to be the focus point for this next epic, if you will. But you know, look, nobody woke up at any point and was like, "Well, now we're in the Middle Ages, you know, stop showering or whatever." Like, you know, or now we wake up and like, "Well, it's the Renaissance, we should all shower." Like, that's nothing like that ever happened. None of these people, nobody knew they were living in the Middle Ages. This is something we are putting
No.
on the world. So it inevitably kind of says more about us than it does about anything else.
I'm absolutely positive that Ammianus Marcellinus was had a chapter ready to go, the last chapter in his epic work, and saying, "Yeah, I think the Roman Age is gone now. I think you know, he was over in Antioch when he's saying, yeah, I think from now on we'll just call it the Middle
Something
Ages."
is fundamentally cracked, which it really kind of
Maybe.
has. And you could, I'm certainly there's some people listening who, you know, the bringing in of Germanic tribes into the kind of Roman sphere of influence and making them part of the army, it precedes this battle, but this battle, nevertheless, is such a great way to sort of get at that shift, as you said, that totally changes things and will lead to one of several falls of Rome. The
Yes,
falls of
one of
Rome,
several. I'm sure we're going to have to put on the list the actual 410 siege and probably the Vandal siege later on too of Rome, because they're important in their own concept as
They
well.
are,
But
yeah.
and in defining this period, I think. And you're right, militarily, this is very, very it, well. The, this is a A change. There's not a. There's going to be definitely a change. As the first, this is not the first emperor who dies. In fact, the emperors since Severus has they more often die in battle than they die. Well, in fact, only one dies of natural causes from there to Diocletian. But it seems so. It seems that this, to me, would start a new. It starts the Middle Ages. And I could. Maybe there's somebody out there who could give me a convincing argument why not. But curiously, what you just said is remind me again how this could have changed. This could have ended so differently, this battle. In fact, the whole campaign could have ended because this is a migration. I've always thought about this. In fact, indicated this to me as a desperation campaign, but it's also a migration campaign for the Goths. They are welcomed in to the Roman Empire. There, the Roman policy in 376 is to allow the Goths to cross the Danube and settle in Thrace. It doesn't, but then it's almost as if the Romans either didn't conceive how many were coming in, so they thought they were going to have a very small migration, or they completely messed up the administration and the bureaucracy of this afterwards.
It's probably a little bit of both, right? They weren't ready for what came, and the response to it was one of fear, and a kind of conservatism of, close the borders, as it were, like that kind of mentality. I mean, not literal, but that kind of mentality that then. I mean, the Goths don't appreciate that. You said we were welcomed in. We were supposed to be federati, and now we're going to be treated like we're garbage. Like, are you kidding?
Yeah, we're supposed to be fed
Yeah,
federati too.
right.
And this is there's some I and even Ammianus, now Ammianus Marcellinus, who does not like Valens, we'll say that right off the bat. In fact, probably end with some of his comments about
And
Valens.
he is the
He's
great source for this. For this battle. Yeah.
a great source. Yeah, and he's a military man himself. He's retired in Antioch. He's been a very strong devotee to the apostate, Julian the Apostate, who dies in 363 on campaign that Ammianus misses, or he's supposed to go on to and then doesn't make it there. I mean, Julian dies to the Persians 363, and it's really. It's not a confused affair after Julian dies. It's made more later because he's trying to go away from Christianity himself, and so I think there's some ideas of Julian that don't really have a lot of don't really make a lot of sense. There's a seamless inheritance by Valens, and he's now the head of the Roman Empire. There's no question. But Ammianus doesn't like him. And Ammianus consequently tells us some things about the Goths that are quite interesting. And he seems to almost have sympathy for them. He initially says the Roman census takers lose count. There's so many that have come across the Danube, they lose count. And then over the next few chapters of Ammianus, you realize that they. Goths aren't getting fed, and they're getting desperate.
Yeah, which is a bad scene for anybody, right? A desperate people is not going to lead to anything good. And
Exactly
it's
right.
not as if Rome was like going great blazes itself at this point. I mean, the crisis of the third century, was the previous century, and it lasted a good long haul. They were not good for the Roman Empire. So they were already kind of reeling. And now we've got
Yeah, and
this.
the civil war, this yeah, the civil war that Constantine has that will eventually end at Milvian Bridge has really sapped the Roman military capabilities, but doesn't replace it with anything better. In fact, why keep going over to Persia? That doesn't work well for about a century and a half before Julian dies over there. And Valens, in fact, when the Goths start going on the warpath, so to speak, he's in Antioch himself. He's going to campaign against the Persians. It seems, don't go east, young
Never,
man.
never get involved in a land war in Asia. That is
Exactly right.
a hard one rule right there.
I went in the rule right there. But the other thing is if you invite people in, you've got to feed them. And I figure it takes about two years. It would have taken about 2 years for the Goths to get Thrace producing agriculture sufficient to feed themselves. But they're not given a year.
Yeah. So, I mean, as background, this is really the key information to the background of this, that you have a group of immigrated Goths, a massive people. I don't want to say group, like it's a small group, but it is a mass amount of people that have in turn been pushed out. There's a reason that they're needing to migrate, and so they've come in. They were originally welcomed in. And allowed to cross over, but things don't go well. And obviously, exactly what is happening on the ground, kind of hard to say at this point. We have Marcellinus, what he's saying, but he's no friend to Valens for sure. So if he can throw him under the bus, he's gonna.
And he's writing after Valens is lost too. So it's I don't know what Ammianus would have said had Valens won. I mean, would he still have the antipathy towards him? My guess is he would, but I don't. But maybe not be as harsh. Victors always get off a little bit easier than losers, quite a bit easier than losers. That was an understatement. But it should be said also, Mike, that the Federati system had worked elsewhere in the empire, and not only benefiting the empire by bringing by bringing peaceful settlement in to areas that were bordering the bordering the lands that might be that might provide enemies for the Romans, but just also bringing prosperity. I mean, this was what was happening up in the northern Gaul with the Franks. They were being settled in this way and had be provided a lot of easy transition and
Well, and
peace.
it's something, I mean, it'll continue forward, right? Normandy is basically the same thing happening, to the
Yes,
kind of the
that's
next wave, right? So, so yeah, there's a historical practice of this and an intelligence to it. When instead of trying to fight over this border, how about we, for the greater good of both parties, figure out a way to make this work? And it, as you said, it often does. Sometimes it doesn't. In this case, it did not spectacularly, in an absolute
Spectacular.
spectacular failure of working out. Yeah, I mean, we assume most of the blame here is on the Roman side.
Well, it's hard not to. I mean, I have had I have read a couple of things that try to defend the Romans and, well, they didn't know how many were going to cross or anything else. Fact of the matter is that they're at the bottom of all the Federati treaties is, a note to Romans in all caps, feed the folk, feed the folk. Because they cannot stand on their own two legs until they get until they get produce coming out of the ground that they're occupying.
Right, which, as you said, takes time. This is not something that happens overnight. So they're going to need assistance until they get to that point, and then they're now a successful part of the empire, and everyone wins. But yeah, it doesn't happen here. So when things start to go south, crossing the Danube, going south. Hey,
Yes.
now,
Did
when we
not.
start to get a problem. We have a number of players on the board. Emperor Valens is going to be very much, he's the emperor and he's the one that screws all this up. But We also have on the side of the Goths, a main leader there is Fritigern. And there are also some other Roman generals we probably be useful to know.
Yeah, well, I mean the probably the most important one because it does his absence affects this conflict is Gratian, who's he's either co-emperor or he's seen as the as an kind of as an emperor and Caesar sort of a situation like Constantine like Diocletian had with Constantius and others, but he doesn't he's got a big army, but it's in the west right now. It's dealing with around the Rhine
And
region
doing well.
and
Yeah,
doing well.
Gratian's doing well. And this, we think, is actually in a way part of the problem, because Valens doesn't want to be like I'm second fiddle to this guy, right? I'm Emperor Valens. Can't have this Gratian guy getting all the records. Here I am, got Jordan on my team, but he's scoring all the points. I don't like that. Like, I gotta outscore him. And so he tries. I think that's actually my second like weird Jordan reference. Like
It
a couple
may be,
podcasts.
for all those out there, we're talking basketball in the 80s, really,
Don't
but
know what the hell.
NBA in the 80s. But I think it's right, and of course, I'm shocked that there's a Roman emperor who allows his ego to determine
Stunning.
at this stunning since the second century. I mean, what are they? The ego of Roman emperors are amazing because they get put in these positions very quickly. Valens at least served for a few years, but most of them are put in these positions raised by one group of troops. Another group of troops comes over and says, "Well, we want our guy to be emperor." No, that can't happen. We can't share the throne.
What a wreck. Because yeah, he's doing terrific. Certainly relative to what Valens does. And as a result, Valens, I don't want to get too far ahead, but Valens will go into this kind of back where I come from, we'd say half cocked. But like he doesn't have everything he needs. Partly out of ego and probably just like a desperation, like I'm gonna get this done. Like I want the glory, I want it now, and I don't want to wait and have to share it with anybody. I'm coming in hot, and
And it may not be. I mean, I think looking at this campaign, and we're getting to the battle very quickly, guys, now, but they have to build it up. I think that the Valens had everything he needed if he wanted, if he could have fought a battle wisely, he might have won himself. But everything he wanted, everything he needed versus everything he could have had. If Gratian joins up, I mean, which is entirely different. It would have been an entirely different result, I think, had the two Roman armies been there, both with experienced troops, and fighting a pretty inexperienced group of Goths who were just trying to survive, desperation.
Yeah, I think you're right. This is a winnable fight, an eminently winnable fight, even with what Valens has. With Gratian, it's like a no contest kind of thing, to my mind. But this is still absolutely winnable, even with what Valens has. I mean, and we'll get to it in a second. It's not like he's got, four dudes and a bike. Like he's got a significant army at his disposal.
He's got a significant army, yeah.
But he could have won this and loses in such spectacular fashion. Yeah, it's cool beans. So there's another Western reference, cool beans.
Cool beans. Don't eat
Don't
beans,
eat beans,
cool.
cool. You get the warm stuff. It's in the chuck wagon, y'all. All right, so as background to this, the relationships are souring.
Yeah,
What
all of them.
does Valens do? How does he respond to this? How do we get to this battle?
Well, I think I mean for the first year, so it takes about a year before the Goths start recognizing that they're starving, and but Ammianus says that they're really desperate. They're actually selling their children for food, and you get the feeling from what Valens is saying is they're not selling them; they're selling them into slavery because that'll keep the kid alive, as well as possibly get some food for the rest of their family. They're eating dogs and they're doing whatever they can to survive. The Byzantines, Eastern Romans at this point, have kind of gone all back behind walls. The one thing the Goths can't do, as it seems, is attack a walled city, and there's a lot of walled cities over in the Eastern Empire, and so they've really kind of just washed their hands of this and just moved back into the cities, hoarded the food, and brought them back there. And so the Goths have, by 377, the Goths are really now out for war, out to find anything they can. And there's Romans, Valens sends in his generals and he sends in his armies. There's some conflicts before Adrianople.
There is. I mean, this overwhelms them all.
Yes.
In terms of scale, there's no question about that.
In 377, there's about as many victories for the Romans as there is for the Goths, it should be said.
It's a back and forth of these little, battles and skirmishes and yeah, I mean, I guess we haven't counted them up, but it's probably like, 50-50. I mean, it's just, we win this little bit, we win that little bit, and nothing's really getting resolved here. It's just kind of, perpetual violence. It does seem, I agree with you, the Goths, for them, this isn't a campaign of like vengeance or something like that, or of conquest. It's a campaign of, if we take that town, there's food, there's supplies, there's stuff we need. Let's take it, right? And then the Romans count like, how dare you hit that town, right? And come after them, and then they have to respond to that in turn. So it is it's a horrible situation in terms of humanitarian crisis that is becoming a military crisis.
And it's not, this is not this is really violent, and it turns. I mean, we don't want to minimize this to by saying, well, there's equal numbers and everything. I mean, Valens' comment is, and this is what he says about it. He says everything was consumed in an orgy of killing and burning that paid no regard to age or sex. Infants were snatched from the very breast and put to death. Mothers ravished and married women widowed by seeing their husbands killed before their eyes. Boys of tender years or post-adolescence were dragged over the corpses of their parents. So there's a violence that is that, and I think this is violence of rebellion. When you get into the desperation mode, it's not, and you've been forced to do it by a people who seem now to not really care. I think that that's when the Goths just say, yeah, okay, then we don't care about you either. Value of human life just dissolves. And now they're killing everybody and stealing everything they can to survive.
And that's you said Valens. I think you meant Ammianus Marcellinus.
Ammianus Marcellinus, sorry.
But yeah, it is. It's a awful. Even if that's one of these things. Like if what we're being told is 50% accurate, it's incomprehensibly horrific, right? And there's a good chance it's 100% accurate. Like it's that kind of thing. It's really an awful humanitarian crisis with a military crisis, with an impending political crisis. It's like everything is coming to a head, really. And that happens when Valens, to his credit, I guess I would say, from his perspective, I'm kind of pro God in this whole thing.
It's hard not to be, even with those comments of Valens that I just read.
It's, I mean, obviously I'm you know, I mean, no, nobody should be hurting civilians is the issue. I'm not like pro anybody, but I'm like, you know, the Romans kind of like started this too. So like, oh, what are we gonna do? But certainly from Balin's position, he says, "What, you know, well, I gotta go in and put a stop to this. Like the destruction is getting so rampant, it's becoming a problem. You know, even though we have, you know, these walled cities and stuff, it is becoming an issue of control in the entire province." And so goes in himself, right? I'm gonna take control of this myself. The autocratic move.
Which is interesting. Interesting because he's had a couple of victories. I mean, other generals have had a couple of victories, and you wonder if, again, it's Valens' ego in this, saying, "Well, I'll move over to Constantinople and see how it's going. Oh, there's a couple of victories. Now I'm going to go do the final blow and get all the
Right,
glory."
have my kind of triumph, as it were. Yeah, I totally see it that way. I mean, but also I'm like so anti-Valens. You know, like this guy, this guy. And so I'm like, yeah, of course he wants the glory of this. But you know, to kind of to be fair, as if one needs to be fair to this guy, but this is a. You know, if we're going to make a final striking blow, we need to have kind of all arms at bear. And what better way to do that for me to come out and kind of take control? And we're going to like, you all work for me. So don't be fighting each other. We're all going to do this together and we're going to smash. So, okay, maybe that works. And Gratian, of course, is like, well, I'm pretty much mopped up out here. So I'm coming. I'm coming to help.
Yeah, he's somewhere in the Balkans when the Battle of Battle of Adrianople happens. He's not like months
Yeah,
away.
he's en route. He's en route. If you just would have waited, man. But yeah, I think that again comes back to this ego. Like he can't wait. I think I got enough. Let me just do this. So this all ends up happening in. Outside Adrianople. We've
Not entirely certain about the
yeah, we've no
terrain.
idea where.
They haven't
We've
located
no
it.
idea where.
Valens doesn't, or Ammianus Marcellinus does not give us a lot about the terrain, but he just says the Goths are on one side and the Romans are on
Yeah,
the
it's
other.
like super helpful. It's got to be close to Adrianople, which is modern Edirne in Turkey. So we know like the basic region. Given the few little clues we have, it needs to be probably north, northeast, or east. So it's in that kind
Northeast,
of quarter quadrant of direction from Adrianople. That said, if somebody actually found remains and it was southwest, we'd be like, ah, okay, you know, we don't have a lot to go on here.
No, there is a house. There's a farmhouse. That's all
According to
we
one
know.
story,
No, and that'll come into play. That'll come into play. And the Goths seem to have their divisions. They seem to have a rough number of cavalry, but not a dominant cavalry arm. It was mostly infantry, whereas the Romans seem to have both and archers.
and that cavalry on the Goth side is actually used to be kind of a matter of. Of I don't know, import that people over exaggerated. Was that Oman that did that? He said this is where knights started, medieval knights.
It is Oman, but Delbrück, who is really pro-German, of
Yeah.
course, he mythologizes Delbrück's second volume. If you've ever wanted to read a great Nazi tract, here are the proud Germans coming in and wiping out the Romans on every turn, and all fiction. But yes, it used to be that before people actually looked, Ammianus Marcellinus tells us, and there are other things that other reports that tell us, the Gothic cavalry is not an overwhelming group at this point. And there is, they're using them, they're using them pretty much to allow the infantry to get into a good advantageous position. And the Gothic cavalry is not a wing of the army itself so much as a wing of.
And not, it doesn't appear anyway, from what Amiana says, terribly like well organized and kind of prepped for battle here. In the case of the, of this battle, when the Romans, when Valens marches out, is it okay to go ahead and skip to that action? All right. So yeah. When he marches out, in what direction? We don't know. this is honestly, I was just like, where are the roads? Follow them, pick a spot. But when he marches out, the Goths, according to what we're told, have taken a position and have an encampment, right? They have a massive mm-hmm. encampment.
Yeah.
It's surrounded by wagons. We call this in other contexts a Wagonburg, essentially. But it's, you know, again, back where I come from, circle the wagons. This is no new thing. And in that position, the Romans approach, and it looks like almost from the start, Valens starts to lose command and control.
Yes, yes. Very, I think that's absolutely dead on. And not a lot of people who write about this battle look at that. They want Valens to at least retain something. But there's an attempt at negotiation, it appears, at least according to
Amiana's exchange, yeah.
The Romans send out, they're going to negotiate. We don't know whether they're still in negotiation or whether it's just after the legation has come back to the Romans, and they just completely violate it. Everybody just runs ahead.
Yeah, one main group in particular kind of decides we're going to go ahead and attack. But there's no command and control. There's no support of this attack.
No, there's no support of the attack. And it doesn't seem to be led by any, well, at least Marcellinus doesn't ever tell us who might be leading it. It's not Valens himself. So there has to be somebody, but geez, it's a rather stupid move for the Romans to make initially, let alone going against the negotiations they've just been making.
Right, right. And this, you know, there's various explanations for why this could have happened. You know, was this emotional, right? You know, that, you know, you guys, these Goths hit our village and come on, boys, screw it, we're going in. Totally possible. You know, we kind of see that thing all the time in history. Was it instead a failure of, they thought this was the plan and nobody else knew it was the plan or thought it was the plan? So it was a misunderstanding in that way. What made them do this? We don't know. Amiana said, I mean, it could also be they're exhausted. They've probably marched. Well, again, we don't know exactly where the battle is, so we don't know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what, 10 miles, maybe a little less, maybe a little bit more that day. It's August. It's a hot day. That can lead to kind of a, you know, short circuiting of the mind, as it were. Maybe that's we don't know. But a group of a significant contingent of the Romans makes the charge, makes the plunge. But not everybody goes with them. It's like this.
No, no. No, in fact, nobody goes with this group. I mean, it takes, it's almost as if there's somebody, if you're playing a board game out there, and you just move half the board up. And then, or a tenth of the board up, and the rest of them are sitting.
Yeah, and the rest of them are looking like, what are you guys doing? Like, what the hell are you doing? As these folks go up, they get repulsed and wrecked because there's no support. The Roman military practice, like, requires these kind of lines of support. It's a very, to its credit, very kind of organized way of warfare. You lot just go run up there and smash into those things. That's not how this works.
No. And especially since they do, they go smash into it
and then run away. There's no,
nobody coming in with a 1-2 punch there. There's a one
punch and now run away. There's no cover, what we call cover fire today. There's no, I mean, it's just, it's just absolutely disaster, which only serves to heighten morale on the part of the Goths, lower it on the part of the Romans. So that's not good. Like that's a double whammy. And of course these guys got beaten to a pulp when they did this. So you've also lost strength. And all of that to me is at the feet of Valens. Like that is a loss of command and control. Yeah. Who's that fall on the feet of? The commander. Like that's him.
It completely makes his archers useless too, because now they can't shoot into a melee, because you're going to hit your own men, and it really makes his Valens' cavalry useless too, at least in this, because they cannot go in to support this group that's gone ahead on their own. Their cavalry also appears to be on the other side of the battle, so it would be nice. I mean, Valens is dealing with eyewitnesses to the battle, but he's obviously got nobody who's listening to command. He doesn't know what the legation has decided. He doesn't know any of this stuff, but he just knows that it's
Ammianus, not Valens.
Ammianus, Well, I don't know. Valens doesn't seem to know anything either, really.
Just want to keep anything straight. If somebody's at home is like, Valens wrote about this? No. Ammianus.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Ammianus. We don't know if this was some kind of plan that Valens had. It's the stupidest plan in the world. So it just looks like he lost control and then tries to salvage the situation, sort of.
Yeah, it seems almost as if he tries to salvage the situation after that group has been beaten. So there's nothing like somebody says, oh, look, the first unit is rushed into battle. Let's follow them. And there are the battles like Campaldino. We've talked about this, where the others go blindly following the first group and lose because they do it. In this case, it's almost as if they go lose and then Valens says, oh, let's follow.
Yeah, which, I mean... Yeah, I guess you could say in a sense is almost like that then is command and control, because you think back to or forward, depending on how we want to think about it, the siege of Caen in 1346,
mm-hmm.
right? When the French recoil back from Edward III's force, he loses control of the army. And guys start chasing after the townsfolk that are rushing back into the walls, and he just loses. He's like telling everybody to stop, and they ignore him, and they all go storming in, and they end up taking the city. This huge success, and Chris is then like, "Ta-da! I meant to do it." But there he lost command and control. Here, it looks like Valens loses control of these guys who go off, but he's able to keep everybody else. Like, no, don't! I didn't give the order to run. I didn't give the order of charge. Like, just so let's just all chill. But then, as you say, when he finally gets off of that, now he can't do anything to help these guys. They're all toast. And now he's like, oh, let's go ahead and do this against what we were just, with our delegation trying to. So we're just going to show ourselves to be oath breakers again. It's Valens is not a good general.
No, oath breaking and all this stuff. There's no way at that point that he could call back and say, remember those talks we just had? Let's go back to that. Not when he's had a whole group go in and they've proven to be woefully insufficient to continue to fight. It also appears that way, and when we have one source, our interpretations are obviously trying to fill the gaps. And what the sources is. To me, it also seems that it doesn't, that the rest of the army doesn't enter as a whole, that it's kind of like a wave that comes in. And so there's a group that comes in, and then another group that follows, another group that follows, and that the Goths are able to stay in their formation without really having any movement. That this is where the defense always has an advantage.
Yeah, it does look very scattershot. You're absolutely right. I mean, and Fritigern, he's also, they're fighting, this is their encampment, right? They're fighting for, for, for homes and families, basically. And he knows, or, well, that's actually where we kind of, we wish we had the source on their side. Does he know that he's got another punch of his own that he's going to be able to land? Very much like, yeah, what is going on there? Because we know when it shows up, when the other punch hits, because as this, you know, these waves that Kelly's describing are kind of smashing up against this hill, getting pretty much nowhere.
No, they're not moving. Well, they can't. They've got to. That's the wisdom of having Wagenberg at the rear. So that he, you know, Valens' troops can't run away. They've got to run around the Wagenberg. And so that tactical choice, and with this new group that you're mentioning that comes in, seems to, for me, Fredegern has a reserve. The Romans don't. And why the Romans don't have a reserve, to me, again, is a failure of Valens' tactics, Valens' generalship.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, because we get, in the middle of all this melee, the Gothic cavalry shows up. And when the Gothic cavalry shows up, now, you know, again, were they in reserve? Were they, you know, there's some people who think that they were, that because Fritigern wasn't anticipating a fight here, they're actually kind of out foraging, I guess, would be a decent word for this. You know, that they were out recon. They're sort of out doing other things. And then, oh, my God, there's a battle. Turn around and get back there. And it's just like, this is when they arrive at the field. Or were they a reserve? And Fritigern's like, hit them now. And here comes the Gothic cavalry. We don't know. I want it to be a reserve.
I do too, but I think there's a logic behind that, and I can't understand these other interpretations that have them. Yes, sure, the Gothic cavalry could be out pillaging and everything else, but having that big, huge Wagenberg indicates to me either there's a central body of non-combatants that Valens is protecting, or he's protecting Fredegern.
You're putting Valens everywhere, man.
I'm putting Valens everywhere.
Seeing Valens in your sleep.
I know. Yeah, well, I did, actually. but it seems to me that he, everything is massed around the protection of this Wagenberg.
Yes, I agree.
And that would then say you're not going to let your cavalry go wandering away from that central spot when you have a Roman army in front of you. And so to me, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I can't understand the interpretation to say that they're just out, you know, what is it, Ferdinand the Bull, sniffing the flowers.
Well, and it's it's not like, I mean, Fritigern didn't think that there was, you know, that they were necessarily going to fight. But he also knew the army was coming. You know, like you have enough recon out there to know in that 8 to 10 miles, whatever it is that they marched that day. That's because, you know, look, we haven't said it, but the numbers, the Roman side is tens of thousands. Like, this is, it would have been a lot more if Gratian got there, but it's big. That is a massive force. You knew it was coming. And so, you wouldn't have your cavalry out kind of gallivanting around. You got them there, and you're just waiting. When are you going to bring them to bear? As you said, it's not probably a huge cavalry. Oman, you know, kind of makes this whole deal about how they this is the moment that knighthood begins, and, you know, blah 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 blah. No, but it certainly is a brilliant. And if it's intentional, which I want to think it is, tactical move to hold them in reserve. And now that things are going the way they are, now they sweep around.
And the numbers might explain this. As you said, the Romans have got a substantial force. We never think of them because there's another Roman army that could have joined them. We never think of them as being an overwhelming force, but they seem to be as large or larger than the
Yeah, I think they're
Goths.
larger, yeah.
And they're much more experienced than the Goths are too, although you wouldn't know it from the first move with this unit going across the battlefield on its own. And so you can understand that Fritigern is keeping the cavalry, because if they were to surround his defensive formation and the Wagenburg, he's got to have somebody who can knock a hole so he can get people out if they have to retreat. So it all falls into place that Fredegern is definitely the best general on the field, but that he also has planned this out a little bit better than some of the interpretations want to have with the cavalry out on their lonesome.
Yeah. And once and look, once the Gothic cavalry enters into this is it's fait accompli. Because we now start getting Roman units are trying to flee. They're getting it in the back. And it's at some point in all this mess, Valens himself gets ditched. And like
Or
or
he ditches himself.
Yeah, this wonderful story. Before we get to the story, do you want the story to be true?
I do because it is such an epitaph, if you
Such an
will.
epitaph. So, according to the story,
Amianus's story,
Ammianus's
we must say.
story, Valens, trying to get away, runs into a house, barn. Yeah, it depends on how you perceive this
Farmhouse,
little
whatever.
cottage. Goes in. He's got a couple dudes with him. Everybody else has ditched him because he's an idiot. And so the here comes the Goths, and they try to just grab stuff from the cottage. Like, they don't know the balance is in there. They're like,
No.
we're gonna just take stuff, like probably food or whatever. In the process, though. Some of Valens' guards, these few people he's got with him, shoot at the Goths, and so the Goths say, "Well, forget this." They set fire to the place.
Yeah, light them up if you got
Yeah,
them.
yeah. And the other everybody jumps out except for Valens, and they're like, "Don't you know who's in there? It's Valens." And they're like, "Oh no." Oh well.
Darn, yeah.
And yeah, he gets torched. You want
Yeah.
that to be true?
Well, it is interesting because I'm sure that this is a legend to keep Valens. I'm sure it's a story to explain why Valens' body is never found afterwards. Also, I think it could be a story just to say, well, this putz is up, gets roasted alive, and nobody will save him. Nobody, even in his own army, doesn't want to save him. His own, no, there's none of this, as we saw Crecy and Charles IV being, taken off the battlefield and protected, Philip VI being taken off the battlefield. It's kind of like Valens, who's that? Who was that again? No.
Yeah,
And the Goths aren't going to
I.
save him. I don't think they recognize that there's any reason to save the emperor on the other side.
I. This is a horrible way to go, and I don't want. It's a horrible. I don't think it's real. I don't think it's real. I think this is make believe, but it also is a hell of a story. One has to say it's a hell of a story, and the key point, as you said, is look, Valens goes into this battle and he don't come out. This
No, he
is it.
doesn't.
Nobody knows where his
No,
body
that's right.
is. Nobody knows anything. It's just gone, which is a massive
And
political blow.
Ammianus, for his benefit, does say he doesn't know whether this is true. This is what he's heard. So it isn't, it's not a situation where we can trust Ammianus all the way up to this and then say, no, this has got to be fiction. He actually says, I don't know whether this is true.
Yeah, and for those who want to read the account of Ammianus Marcellinus, it's item 67 in the Medieval Warfare Reader.
Medieval warfare reader. Yes.
Yeah, and he says in all this, which is just It is a it's a brutal read, the whole story of the battle. Yeah, they he says barely a third of our army escaped, is what he says. Barely a third. So, you know, you're talking a 66% casualty rate, KIA rate, essentially. That is astonishing. Decimation is 1 in 10. Like,
Yes, I know. This is, and I think the most poignant, and this is not Ammianus, this is Jerome, who's in Milan at this time, and or Ambrose, sorry, Ambrose is in Milan at this time, and Ambrose writes and says, many women in Constantinople did not know where their husbands were.
awful, awful. And the result of this is a pretty massive, really massive blow to Roman imperial politics, at least in the short term. This is a major problem, and it compounds existing problems that the Roman army was having in kind of maintaining strength. To have had something go this badly, to lose and several major generals were also lost. Now the Goths could not take Adrianople. They tried afterwards.
And they even went all the way up to Constantinople and
Yeah, they
couldn't
couldn't
take
take it.
it,
As
so.
Kelly said, taking walls seems to be something they were having difficulty doing, because the walls were well defended, and they're walls. So, as you know, as long as they're well defended, well manned, it's difficult to do that. But it still was an absolutely brutal blow. And I think, as we kind of started off with, really does change, you know, the way that the Roman Empire thought of itself, thought of its armies, thought of its methods. It's kind of a big deal.
Ammianus understands this. That's one of the reasons why I think we've grown to appreciate his account and not, not to see it as being far-fetched or anything, even though he's not there. I mean, he ends it by saying, "No battle in our history except Cannae was such a massacre."
Yeah. You do not want to be mentioned in the same breath as Cannae if you're on the losing side.
Of a Roman,
That's
if you're
that is
Roman, that's for
not
sure.
yeah, not a good one. Yeah, what do you wish we had for this one?
Well, I'd love more accounts. There's no question. It'd be nice to have something from Fredegund's side. We're assuming from Ammianus, who's hearing it from Romans, not from any of the Goths, that they're. It would be lovely to know whether Fredegund had, for example, this had noticed had his cavalry as reserve, and I'd like something from nearer to Valens. I mean, Ammianus, well, he says this. He's, I don't have anything that's near anybody who's near to Valens. So he doesn't. He's not making up anything. He just says that when he gets to these points, he says, "Yeah, I don't know what the legation was doing. I don't know where they've, what they had decided. I don't know what this. I'm sure that he's, if I'm reading, not reading too much into it, I think he wishes he had something as a historian who's writing this down, and as a military man writing this down, he would like to know what the command was like, because it's not just us who think that Valens is a bad
Yeah.
general. I mean, it starts with him."
Yeah, and for good reason.
What about you? What would you like to have? I mean, I think I just mentioned I like to have
Yeah,
everything.
you'd like to have everything. I mean, the thing, and I said it earlier, you know, the thing that I most want here is that, you know, something on that Goth side, because I want to know, you know, it does Fritigern, you know, is this a tactical move with the horse? Like, we know the outcome. But we don't know the ingress to that. We don't know if this was truly planned. I want to think it was. I want to believe it was. I do not know if it was, and I would like to know. I would like to know, because that would be just awesome. He really was playing that kind of chess. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, he was playing chess without a few characters, a whole bunch of pawns, but nobody else. The interesting thing that I find after the battle is that Gratian turns around. He doesn't go back. He doesn't go forward now and attack the Goths. He turns around and goes back into the West. And that seems that he either gets word that it's not going to be an easy go, or he assumes that it can't be an easy go if he does continue to fight the Goths. But the Goths seem to also then go into peace, and within a few years, they're now being hired by the Roman army to make up as units and become rather peaceful parts of the empire for a few years before they go back out on campaign.
Yeah, the end of the Roman Empire took a long time, happened many times, and is very complicated, as our students find out whenever we hit these kind of spots in the semester or whatever, and you're like, which fall? What fall? What constitutes a fall?
Yeah.
Tell me what the Roman Empire is. Like, let's define that. Like, it gets to be a mess because of things like that, right? You know, the incorporation of Goths and you know, what, mm-hmm. how does yeah. that change how we define the empire or whatever? It's history doesn't afford a lot of clean things.
No, it doesn't. And the interesting thing about the Roman Empire on this side, we never do get the fall of the Eastern Empire. It will become the Byzantine Empire and doesn't fall until 1453, which gives people like Gibbon a hard time trying to end the fall of Rome. He keeps wanting to push it to 1453, at least for the Roman Empire, which he wants to conceive of continues in the Byzantine world, which I don't think it does. But there are some, one of my professors, Walter Gover, always pushed that this wasn't a military fall. This really was kind of a evolutionary fall. And people like Bernie Bacharach agreed with him. And then we've got the others who say, no, total military fall, Peter Heather and others who want that. And I have to go along with that. I think I'm sorry. Sorry, Walter. And Bernie, may you rest in peace. Sorry that I believe there's a military fall, and I believe it begins here.
Well, on that note, they are closing the doors. Please do join us next time. Hope you all enjoyed this conversation. Next time, we'll be talking about the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, I think it was. Is that right? It's a little known thing. So,
a minor battle has very little ever been written about it. You know, it's like the Battle of Otte. We're going to go to Otte 2, except this was not as well.
So yeah, we're going to do the Battle of Agincourt. Hope that you join us for that. It should be good times.
And you must announce Agincourt, your book.
If you're reading this, my book on Agincourt is out. So if you're listening to this, I should say, as we're recording it, it's not out yet, but by the time this is released, it'll be out. So my new book on Agincourt, Battle of the Scarred King, is out. So I'm sure that will come up in that conversation. Be like, you did what with the battle? So we'll see. That'll be fun. Hope everybody enjoyed it. As ever, a reminder, this podcast is sponsored by medievalists.net. So the best way to support us, other than buying our individual books, of course, like Agincourt, is to join their Patreon at patreon.com/medievalists. That's also the absolute best place to drop us a line if you have questions for our Q&As. Cheers, everybody.
Bye.